Welcome to the FASD Success Show, the only podcast where you can get real-world information about fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. This show will help you create calm in the chaos, have hope for the future, and more importantly, save your sanity so you don't lose your flipping mind. Now, here's your host, caregiver turned world FASD educator, Jeff Noble.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the FASD Success Show, episode number 61. I'm your host, Jeff Noble. Whether this is your first episode or your 61st episode, thank you so much for joining us. You know, this podcast is all about creating FASD success, whether you're an individual on the spectrum, a frontline worker, a teacher, a doctor, a lawyer, a social worker, a mother-in-law. It does not matter. What matters is that you're here because you want to learn more about the disability that is 2.5 times more prevalent than autism, a disability that is probably the leading cause of intellectual disabilities on the planet, but yet it is one of the least known about, least accommodated, least talked about. So that's what we're here to do. And how do we do that? We do that by talking to amazing people. And today, guys, our guests, I'm telling you, pen and a piece of paper. I call this one a 10-timer. I've called episodes like this a 10-timer in the past. What does that mean? It means it's going to be excellent. It means our guest today, Debbie Reynolds Michaud, is going to bring the knowledge bombs. And she's, I call her a triple threat, and I'll tell you a little bit why in a minute. But if you really like the show, what I would love for you to do is if you could subscribe to said show, if you could not only subscribe to said show, but maybe share it with someone or even leave an awesome review. The reason why is because any positive input to our show makes the algorithm go beep, 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 boop, boop, boop. And what that does is put it higher. It shows more folks who are looking for podcasts like this that we exist and we're out there. So in a way, just by, subscribing, just by sharing it, even leaving a review, what that does is it helps us. So just by listening and doing those few things, you could really help the show. And I really appreciate that. Okay, enough of that. What else is going on? I'll tell you what else is going on. We made some updates to FASDsuccess.com/podcast. We put the recent episodes list. We also put a search bar because I know folks were looking for stuff about, aggression or sleep or adult transitioning, all those things that we talk about. And now there's a sweet search bar, so you can go there, FASDsuccess.com/podcast, and you can see, because we have a blog, right? We have a blog, and every guest that we have, we do a nice little write-up about them, and we also put the things, like the resources that they talk about, we put them right into the blog post. So by all means, go check it out. All right, enough of that. I hope you're doing well. I'm doing well because I believe it's finally spring. I can't say that loud because every time I say that loud, what happens is the weather hears me and it says, no, 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 no. It is not springtime. It is second winter, third winter. But if I look at the forecast, man, we are in the plus. I'm really excited about that. It just does so much for mood. It just, you get that vitamin D, fills your soul. Also, my dogs get a little bit of caught in the sunbeam action, so that must be nice for them too after a long winter. That means we're getting through it. We're getting through things. We're getting through negatives. We're getting through the stuff that we've been carrying for a long time. It is now hopefully spring, which means like it's a rebirth. So do you have stuff that you've been hanging on to? Do you have stuff that's been dragging you down? Well, absolutely you do, or else you wouldn't be human. So I hope that you are getting out there. You probably live somewhere that's awesome, but not here where we live, in Northern Ontario, Canada. But if you had winter, go outside. It'll make you feel better. Gives you that serotonin, gives you that good stuff for your brain. Walk it off. And maybe you're walking when you're listening to this. So you're already doing what I'm asking and you're already going to feel better. And now not only will your body feel better, but I'm going to just fill your mind with excellence. Okay, so our guest today, I just got to get to it, man. So how I met Debbie is I met Debbie at a conference, like a lot of individuals that I meet. Remember when we used to be able to do those conferences? She was just awesome. She was always a presenter. She always held court. She's really, really nice. And then I find out more about her when I did go to actually to her community a couple September 9ths ago. It was really awesome. We got to do some training up there. But I will tell you this, that when I'm learning more about Debbie, this is what I find out. I find out that not only is she a caregiver, right? We're going to talk about her story with all her lovelies. Not only is she a caregiver, but she's a professional at the same time, right? Worked in the child welfare field for a long time. And then not only is she those awesome things, but she's also getting her PhD. Could you believe it? She is getting her PhD. And then she believes, and I believe too, that she says that she was also exposed prenatally to alcohol in the womb, and she's going to tell you that story about her mom and all the awesome things that happened there. So not only is she a caregiver professional, but she has insight, information personally about being on the spectrum as well, and she's going to give you some great info. So I'm not joking. Make sure you have a place where you can take notes, because you're going to want to take them. She gives some great information. So who am I talking about? So here's her bio. Debbie Michaud is a social worker with a BSW, Bachelor of Social Work, MSW, Master of Social Work. She is currently working on a PhD in Educational Sustainability. She has worked for over 25 years in the child welfare field in both frontline and supervisory roles. She is currently teaching at Confederation College in the Social Service Worker Program at Sioux College in the FASD Certificate Program. She, Debbie, is a parent of children with FASD and is also living with impacts of prenatal alcohol exposure, and also provides training in the area of FASD. Get ready to sit under the tree of knowledge. If I'm ready, you're ready. All right, let's go. Friends, here I am. I just read her bio, and you know she knows what's going on. I'm with Debbie Michaud. Debbie, thank you so much for joining me here today.
You're welcome.
Oh, that's excellent. You look fantastic. I know people can't see it, but you look fresh, showered up, all good to go. I only mentioned that in passing, folks, because we were supposed to talk yesterday, and we both forgot, and we both got screwed up, so we're doing it now. So, Debbie, you're interesting, man. You have an interesting story. Not only are you a caregiver, but someone who identifies as being prenatal exposed, and you're also a professional. There's a lot to unpack here, and I want to start with the beginning, okay? In terms of your own personal journey to understanding FASD, did you know something was different when you were growing up about yourself, or did things not really come to fruition until you learned about your kids? Like, help me unpack that.
Yeah. We really need to unpack that. This is what I'm planning to do some work on educationally. But so I was born as a result of a one-night stand. My mother is also suffering with some developmental delays, and she was alcohol exposed herself. So she got pregnant with me. She wasn't with anybody. And you got to remember that this is in the 1960s.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I was little, she said, oh, I got drunk. I mean, I got pregnant with you when I was drinking a bottle of wine, and I drank through my pregnancy until I got morning sickness so bad that I couldn't drink anymore. She found out she was pregnant for me because in March she went out for St. Patrick's Day and she was drinking beer and it was green and she got sick.
Got it.
So I always had issues, but I thought I had issues because my mom would leave me with different family members. She took me one time and we hitchhiked across Canada when I was three. Like, I had a lot of instability. So I thought that maybe that's where my issues came from. And then in 1992, I was in university and we were learning about childhood disorders. And they started talking about FASD. And honestly, I was very shy and I never liked to make any waves in the classroom or anything like that. But I bolted out of my seat and I had to run to the washroom and look at my face.
Well, because they were showing the face on.
Oh, I have the facial features and so does my mom. And it was like everything came into such clear view for me in that moment. And, you know, then I sort of forgot about it. I remember I went home and told my stepdad. I was learning about ADHD and I was learning about FASD all in school. And I'm like, look at this. And he's like, oh my good God. There are some explanations right there, girl.
Oh my gosh. So a revelation for your stepfather as well.
Oh, because he was so amazing. So he hooked up with my mom, and I was 4 when they got together, and he wound up getting into a relationship with her, and he bought us a house. And for the first time in my life, he brought stability to both of our lives. And so, but he suffered, you know, I put him through a lot, and so did my mom. And, you know, he was very, very kind through it all and very stable. So, you know, it was nice, I think, for him to have some explanations too, because I'm sure he worried.
Yeah, absolutely. As you know, as a parent too, you worry. That's what we do, Debbie. That's like what we do most of the time. So to have some answers, I always find such a lift off not only the individual's shoulders, but the shoulders of the caregiver, realizing, okay, we're not crazy. You know, there is something to this. Like, I think this way and act this way because that's something that was beyond my measure. Now, you know, there's every time now that you're talking, a tree branch of questions just pops out. What was your, what was your then thoughts towards your mom once you realized this? Or were you just young that it was fleeting. So it didn't hit hard enough where it made a major claim in your life at that time.
The alcohol use in the pregnancy didn't make a major claim in my life because I do not have any children, biological children with FASD. But if I had biological children, my children would have FASD because I would have used alcohol in pregnancy. All of my friends did. Mm-hmm. That's what we did. It was the bar days. I can't even imagine going through a pregnancy in those days without drinking. And I used to sit and drink with my friends who were from 2 weeks to 9 months pregnant all the time. It's what we did.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't have been angry with my mom for that because it was normalized for me.
Yeah. And I wasn't necessarily pushing towards the anger aspect, but we're like just in general, it didn't really. So it made sense. You went logical right away, which might be one of your FASD superpowers yourself. Honestly, right? So you're like, oh, that makes literal sense. I could see that, no doubt. I would have done the same. See, this comment that you were learning about FASD in 1992, was it a page or did it?
It was a paragraph.
Ah, okay. You see, because I was like, you learned about this. I have so many people on the show, all the way from the doctory of the doctorist, that said, you know, I practiced for so many years, never even heard about it. Okay, so it was a page of a page, but it just struck you. All right, so let's move forward then. When did it pick up? When did this momentum of FASD pick up?
So it wasn't about 1999. So I went to university and I finished a degree without ever hearing about FASD again. And then in 1999, my husband and I became foster parents. And we specifically said, so he worked in developmental services and I worked in child welfare. And we specifically said when making a match with us that we really didn't want to care for kids with developmental disabilities. But it wasn't something that we felt that we could do 24/7. And my husband and I actually met visiting a child with FASD together in our roles.
Right.
So so we started fostering and we had this lovely little girl come into our care and we just fell in love with her. And everybody was saying, well, she's so difficult and we can't really find a placement for her. So once she settled into our home and we started to figure her out, she started to do really well. And I kept saying to him, don't tell anybody how good she's doing because we want to keep her.
Right.
Just amazing. And we really clicked with her and we fell in love with her. And then about 6 months later, after they decided that we could care for her as long as she needed, we found out she had an FASD assessment and she got it quite early. So it was very surprising. It was the first time I'd ever seen an FASD assessment. They provided us a copy. And then that's when we started to learn. It was 1999.
So you and your husband just were instinctual. You just went on instincts, like what you would want to happen in your life. It just so clicked what worked with your disability. Because let's not forget, your husband, Bill, is also identifies as exposed too, right?
That's right. Yep.
Yeah. I'm trying to dance around the language. He believes he's on the spectrum without being diagnosed. Right. And you're the same thing. Maybe we'll tell the listeners, like, what does that mean? What does that mean? Like you self-identify, but not diagnosed.
I don't know. I always say that I'm prenatally alcohol exposed. exposed.
Okay. Yeah, prenatal. Okay, cool. I just want to, with the language, language changes. And
I know, right?
How you're identifying, I want to make sure that I'm learning and not just speaking out of ignorance. Okay, so you start to learn about your girl, you start to learn about FASD. Does the learning go inward, or are we just focused on being caregivers at this point?
The learning doesn't go inward yet. No, it didn't. I can't even remember when I finally realized, but I know when I finally realized, and I'll tell you that when we get there. But yeah, and so we just started intuitively doing things with her that we would have needed. So when she got in trouble at school, for example, instead of giving her a heck, I remember her and I used to lay in bed and she'd cry and I'd wrap her up tight in a blanket and I just let her cry and she'd have a nap and then she'd feel better. Like lots of little things that I knew I would have needed, I was able to provide for her and she started to really thrive.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. So, but then the family gets bigger.
Well, yeah, and we got connected with Judy Kay at the time. It was one of the only programs in Ontario. It was the family support program run through the Public Health Agency of Canada at the time. And she hooked up with us right away, and she started providing us with support and guidance and everything immediately.
Jeez.
And then her siblings came.
Ah, I see. Okay, yeah. So how many more? One or two more siblings?
Two more siblings, and then another girl that was a little bit older than all of them.
At this point, because you figured we got the one and we're doing well, no problem. Like, how did you agree to multiply by two more?
Well, the older girl, she had some of the same issues, and they had seen how well we had done with this child, and so they asked us if we would give it a try. And of course, she fell in love with us right away. She was the most challenging child that I've ever had. But now in adulthood, she's my biggest gift. She's the kindest, sweetest. She's so good to me. And so anyway, I'm digressing.
No, not anyway, because that's the ultimate goal. Parents that are listening right now, Debbie, are like, I want that.
Mm-hmm.
An adult that is so kind to me. So that's not an anyway, that's an everything, I think.
Well, and I think just to put it in perspective, like, she was so challenging. One day she got mad at me and she threw all her bedroom furniture down the stairs. She would scream out the top window saying that we were breaking her arm and we were hurting her, and we'd be standing outside going, oh my God, the police are going to come. You know, she was so hard. And then she left our care when she was 14 or 15 and she was placed in group care, which was so tough on her. And she fell into serious addictions and serious mental health issues. And she's the one actually that I thought had FASD, but never had a diagnosis. And I took her to a telepsychiatry appointment and I asked them to, engage in an FASD assessment for her. And they actually told us to stand up and they told me that she was too tall to have FASD. So she didn't get her diagnosis until she was 16 and she was admitted to the pediatric mental health unit in Thunder Bay. And she finally got it. And the relief that she felt was incredible.
Yeah. Do you remember that?
I do. I remember asking her, how do you feel now that you have your diagnosis? She said, I feel so good because I always thought I wasn't trying hard enough.
Wow. That's a big one.
Yeah. And we had a wonderful, my kids are Indigenous, and we had a wonderful lady who worked with us, and she called us to go to where my child was placed, and she had a beautiful family sweat for us to help us with all of the healing that we needed after her placement broke down with us and that sort of thing. So she was able to come home with her diagnosis and that healing that had happened.
So where's the switch? You know, I know we're talking about her now, but where's the switch? Because parents are listening to the about the 14. They're at that level where she was at 14 years old. They're terrified of the addictions and the mental health and the stuff that comes with it. What was the change? Was it just the development? Like, she got older?
Well, for her, it was the diagnosis, and then it was some of those protective factors, so being able to come home. And then she met someone and she moved to a more isolated community, and she's surrounded by his family, who now acts as her executive assistant,
right,
for lack of a better word. Now, she did fall into addictions pretty deeply as a young adult, too, but she's clean. She's never lost custody of her children, and she's the most amazing mother I have ever met in my life.
So nice. Mm-hmm. That is so nice. What makes her a good mom, like when you're watching her?
Because she's very low key, so she's not the kind of person that would have a meltdown and freak out. She just shuts right down, so she's low key. But what that allows her to do is sit with her children, touch them, hold their hands, cuddle with her babies for hours and hours. Like, she's not so busy that she's got to get up and get out. You know what I mean? She just is with them and in tune with them. The attachment is incredible.
That's nice. Yeah, good. Yes, good introspection. Thank you. Okay, but this is still about you, but, you know, that's what I'm saying. You're so interesting. We could go all over the place. Because, like, you had one, now you have three. And is that, you know, you said she was challenging. So that's when maybe you learned the caregiving lesson of every individual on the spectrum is indeed an individual, and thus accommodations should be approached as such.
Yes, and I also learned by going to get her that diagnosis or asking for it that FASD was not well understood and that most professionals actually ignored it.
Yeah.
As part of their learning.
Yep. It's interesting you say that because possibly a reason, Dr. Mellis, I just talked to him a few weeks ago, that people aren't comfortable with it. Professionals just, it makes them uncomfortable. Anybody's going to avoid things that make them uncomfortable, especially professionally like that. So, yep, absolutely. That would make total sense. So, okay. And at this time, so you got, because I'm just trying to, I know that we're jumping timeline, a little quantum leapy, but that's okay. Now, are you a professional in the field of FASD while you have the three?
Not in the field of FASD. So as I said, I was a child welfare professional.
Right.
And so I was a children's services worker. I was a family worker and investigation worker. And then by the time all the kids came, I was a supervisor.
So you're supervising in the community. And this is my assumption. Are we seeing FASD all over, and yet you're the only one who's kind of seeing it, and that leads to a whole other problem? Are you fighting, you know, the system itself, or how did you navigate those waters? I'm not trying to put words in your mouth is what I mean.
No, it was tough. You're right. I'm sitting here nodding like a crazy fool. Yeah, it was really, really hard. A lot of people didn't want to talk about FASD. They didn't want to look at FASD. I had many children who came through my system in care who I knew were living with FASD, but I had no jurisdiction over the decisions that were made for them. I just cared about them. And they went through the whole system without a diagnosis. Many of them have died. Many of them have ended up in really, really terrible situations. And many of them have lost their own children because they didn't get what they needed in the system.
So now that you're seasoned, do you see a shift now? Is there from when you were the supervisor to now?
Yes, and we were really lucky. So I was screaming it on the rooftop, talking about it. I started doing some training. We started putting on some conferences because I felt like people were less likely to listen to me if I was lecturing them. So we just started putting on free conferences and getting everybody to come to the community. So we had Miles come here. We had Diane Melvin. We had Dan Dabowski. They all came to Sulacoat. And we just wanted to get everybody trained in what FASD was. And then we had some school board folks that were really, really amazing. And they got FASD. And so they accessed a bunch of money from the Child Welfare Secretariat to do something called Eliminating Bridges, Building Bridges. And it was an intensive training program because we were recognizing that kids in care were failing at school because their placements were breaking down and they were moving all over the place because they had FASD and nobody understood it. And so I got to be involved in that program and it was huge.
Yeah, it sounds amazing. And then years later, I got to come to beautiful Sulacoat as well.
That's right.
As well. Okay. But those guys are excellent. Okay, here's what I'm asking. So all this is going on, and you're still not looking inside your own stuff. Are you having, first of all, because if anybody, people are listening to you, if you, you know, you look at your picture, you're getting your PhD, you know, you've got degrees, what's, if I may ask, so then what are some of the symptoms that, you know, you're dealing, that you got to wrangle with?
And so I started, it came in bits and pieces, and they often talk about when you experience trauma and you, it's time for you to start dealing with it, it'll come in bits and pieces. And so that's what happened. The more learning I did, the more bits and pieces. But it, you know, it would always stuck me was that, you know, I had this cognitive ability or this academic ability. And actually, when I went to go get my own assessment, probably around the time we were doing eliminating barriers, building bridges, I went to a facility to get an assessment, and they told me that I was too smart, that I could get up for work every morning, so I didn't have FASD. So I started to realize when I started to get a sense of the sensory issues. I am so sensory sensitive. It is unbelievable. And my sensory issues hijack my thinking to the point where it's really difficult for me to have relationships.
Oh, that's, well, thank you for sharing that. I like the way you said that. Your sensory issues hijack your thinking.
Yes. I call them sensory irritants or hijackers.
So are you in tune now? If you know that, you know, you're in your limbic system a bit, or you're getting irritated, is it more of a, are you looking around sensory wise, knowing thyself, I guess, now?
Yeah. So instead of lashing out at people for touching me too much or having talking too much or too loud or not brushing their teeth and being in my face because I smell everything even from 100 miles away. I'm able to understand that that's me. It's my sensory irritants that are at play. So I just find ways. So the people who really, really love me, I can say to them in a nice way, you know what? I don't think you've flossed your teeth in a while. I'm feeling a little overwhelmed. And, you know, I can say, can we please turn off the TV for a bit? You know, I can do
that.
Yeah,
too loud. You could now say, yes. We got to tone it down. Because, and so when you didn't know what was going on, you had a trouble with relationships because you would lash out.
Yes, I'd be so angry. And how do you love people when they're too loud, they smell funny, they touch you wrong, and you just can't cope? And it's funny, I feel that way with adults, but I never get hijacked in terms of my sensory too much when I'm with kids. It's as if, you know, my sensory issues disappear when I'm with them.
I wonder why that is.
I don't know.
Is it your own expectations of how do you lax because you anticipate that maybe the children are going to be loud, are going to touch you, and they might stink? But do you hold maybe adults to a higher standard?
Yeah, I don't know what it is. I haven't figured it out yet. It's kind of weird, you know. But when you're an adult and you have all of these sensory issues, it's very hard to have relationships, satisfying relationships.
Okay, so yeah, because that's interesting. But people, I would have never, ever known that about you. So that's, I guess, in crux, that's the disability in general, right? So unless you really get to know an individual, I was just talking to Dr. Valerie Temple. I'm not name dropping, but I'm just, because I want you to know that this came from them. You know what I mean? Just citing my source. She talked about that cocktail test. If you go out into a party with, you know, and you're standing around talking to somebody, and you judge their overall intelligence by their communication with you. And if they're a good talker, you just anticipate that they're good in other areas of their life. And what do we know about individuals on the spectrum? That their expressive language far often is greater than maybe their understanding or their synchronizing sequence, you know, the output of that and the internalizing of that. So you would pass all the cocktail tests, but if you were there too long and then it started to get irritating and then, you know, you would lash out, and especially you tried to hold it together and then your loved ones would get it.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. And actually, if you give me a few drinks and we do the cocktail test, all of my sensory issues go away.
Oh, so that would lean into, that could be addictions issues then, right? If that like shut it all down.
Absolutely.
Double-edged sword, and then it would make it worse. Well, I'm not a doctor, so here's the... Okay, so no, let's keep going. Let's keep going. So, because we talked about this stuff, but like when were you officially like, okay, so I'm telling people I'm prenatally exposed. And do you remember the first time maybe you did that in public or...
Yeah, the first time I ever did that was when we were doing the Photo Voice project. And us women were all sort of connected, and we were talking about, you know, lots of things. But I actually brought the women back together again a couple of years later to do my master's thesis, because my professor had seen the project and said, I don't think you're done. I think there's more that these women have to say now that they've developed this understanding. I want you to go back. I had something completely different in my mind, but she wanted me to do that. So when we left the project, I hinted that I may be alcohol exposed, because we had another woman in the group who talked about possibly being alcohol exposed. And she talked about having that scattered profile that we all talk about, just in terms of intelligence and how masked for her. Yeah. So then when we went back to the group, it was first, like I talked to my husband about it. And then that group of ladies, that was the first group of ladies that I ever talked to about, you know, I believe that I have FASD too. And my sister, of course, who has some of the same issues as me.
Was that lifting? Like, how did I can't assume how you felt, or was it just natural?
It was lifting, just because, you know, I always felt like such a heel for having all these sensory issues. I felt like a bad wife. I felt like a bad friend. I felt like a bad community member. I just felt like, you know, I'm the kind of person, everything is just left brain for me. You know, somebody passed away, I'm going to tell you somebody passed away. I'm not going to sit you down and make you comfortable. Like, I don't have that stuff in me either. And so I just felt like a bad person. And then once I realized that it was probably the prenatal alcohol exposure, I started to feel like, okay, I can start to work with this, and I can help everybody around me work with it too.
So good. Because you've been all over the world at conferences, and you've taught, I've seen you half a dozen times. Right. And you usually come with other caregivers. It's really super impactful what you do. Can you tell us some of the stuff you've done in terms of teaching others, like that? I know you have another mom with you. That's powerful. And then I think you talk about FASD and sexuality too. That's you and Rhonda, mm-hmm. right? So just tell us some of the areas that you've presented on.
Okay. So I just wanted to tell you too, Val Temple and I published an article together. It's called The Complexities of Caring for Children with FASD. And that's actually based on the information that I got from the women when we went back from the Photo Voice project. And it's really good.
She also uses scattered profile. So that's why I was like, is this a term, or is this, so that just makes
sense. No, it is a term. And I actually use her scattered profile slide when I do training.
But it's always, this is so connected. And she's awesome, huh?
Oh, she works with Bill.
So that's, oh my gosh, this full circle stuff, I tell you. Okay, cool. All right, keep going.
Yeah, okay. So we usually do training about being a caregiver. We do training about insulation, how to create insulation, how to create interdependent relationships and strong relationships with kids with FASD. Working in the FASD certificate program, I know so much about so much, I can't even sort of hone it down. I've started to research a little bit about suicide in FASD. It's become a very important topic to me. And one of the things that I've recently started to recognize is that people who are suicidal, for example, or who have depression, have low levels of this serotonin receptor called 5-HT. And when you have low levels of that, you're not absorbing serotonin in the same way that a neurotypical person might be absorbing it. And you need serotonin for everything. You need it to feel happy. You need it for cognition. You need it for motivation. You need it for everything.
Is that in the affect regulation area?
Yes, that too. Okay. Yeah, mood stabilization, all of it. Yeah. And so I'm interested in the 5-HT2 because I also have been diagnosed with fibromyalgia. And so I've had to start taking out antidepressants because of that. And it is very connected to FASD. And depression and fibromyalgia, this receptor.
Okay, excellent. Thanks. You're very sherry, and I appreciate that. Folks, I didn't ask her to, you're doing a great job sharing, so I appreciate that, because I have no doubt other caregivers are dealing with the same. Okay, so I lost my train of thought, but I'll get back there.
Okay, we were talking about my interest story, and I divested. So
No. We were talking about like what you do. Oh yeah, okay. This is an excellent tangent. No problem. because you said, and it's fair, I know so much, like, from doing this so much and learning so much and living so much. Okay, now, if a caregiver was to sit down with you, then what are your top three? Like what are you telling somebody? And it's okay, I'm just springing this on you. It's not prepared. But, like, if you had to sum it up, your elevator pitch, there's a caregiver feeling like just total shit going down an elevator, and, you know, you could bestow three pieces on her. What are you dropping?
Oh, to make her feel better or to make her understand child?
Yeah, like, I don't care. Whatever. Like, you can tell her three things. Like, yeah, she's, you know, with COVID, increased aggression she's dealing with. You know, she doesn't think that she could do it. It's hard. Nobody else understands it. What are you saying on the way down? Like, of all my years, this is my three points that I would tell you.
One would be forget about societal expectations, school, all of those things. Love. Just love. Love where they're at. Love who they are. Oh, figure nice. Out where their gifts are and build on those. I have a child who very rarely goes to school. And I'm actually happy about that. He is a happier child. He doesn't have all of those pressures. He's less aggressive with me. He's less aggressive with others. And, you know, he's going to learn to do the things that he loves to do. I just have to support that.
So long are the days of being worried about what other people are thinking.
Forget that. Forget what other people think. You have to walk in relationship with this child. And if you're worrying about what everybody's thinking and how they're managing in the world as a neurotypical person, or at least looking like that, you actually might be causing more harm.
But they want the normal, Debbie. They want the normal. I guess we could take a dive into grief and loss too, but you know, this is... they're not successful unless they're doing what either their peers or perception is.
And I've had the advantage of raising so many kids that I've got to try different ways of raising them. Yeah, so I wanted that normal too. I wanted, yeah. And I fought with my kids to go to school, to do this, to do that, to be in Girl Guides and Scub Scouts and hockey and all those things. Like, I did all of that stuff. And at the end of the day, some of that stuff ruined my relationships with them. And I say, I'm on the 40-year plan. Think about that 40-year plan and what you want at the end of the day. I have a very important story that I want to share with you. Rainier DeSmit came and talked to my class. And one of the things that
Rainier was at your house. Yeah.
But he just recently came and spoke to my class about how being an adult with FASD. Awesome. And one of the things that he pointed out is, you know, he had a very difficult relationship with his parents when he was growing up because they pushed him to do all the neurotypical things. And he had a neurotypical brother who was very successful. And his parents recently passed away in the last couple of years, more recently, his mom. And he was able to be with both of his parents at their bedside through the entire time. He didn't leave the hospital. He just held their hand and he did what they needed him to do. And in the end, he ended up being their biggest gift, even though he wasn't neurotypical.
Yeah,
I want my child to be that gift. I don't care if they're running a company in Texas and in the oil refinery business and they're a millionaire. I want them to be by my side. So at the end of the day, that relationship is so important.
You want mentally healthy kid to turn into a mentally healthy adult, especially the deck stacked against them. You want a good human because a good human will get employment. A good human will get the benefit of the doubt, right? A good human being will, other people will want to be around that good human being. So for the social and the connection, doesn't matter about equations and all of, unless that's their track. Some people that sure like yourself, you're academic, right? So, and you've thrived in school. So that was always sort of stable for you, correct?
Absolutely. Well, when I was in high school and public school, absolutely not. I was a terrible student.
Right.
But when I was older and I got to choose the things that I wanted to learn about. So in high school, I took two courses I ever remember were law and man in society, which was a psychology course. And then when I went into social work, I just thrived like 90s all the way.
Yeah. And you're right. And to get back on the good human, because a good human needs to have good mental health to overcome adversity.
Yeah.
So if we're straining that, if we're straining that, then they have no juice left when adversity, and you know, they're more prone to more adverse outcomes. Then let's pack on the sensitivity to their HPA, hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis. So they're already revving high. They have more adverse outcomes. And so you're an academic and you're saying, if that's not their jam, we're not worried really about school.
No. And I used to tell my the teachers of my kids, I don't care about curricular outcomes. I want my child to like you, to love you. I want you to like my child, and I want them to feel like they belong here. And if we can't make that happen at school, I don't want them to be here.
Yeah. I wonder if people are listening going, well, that sounds a little hippy dippy, but you're saying I've done this. I have had kids. I've been through the gamut, and this, from what I know, both personally, academically, you know, professionally, this is my preferred strategy for the 40-year plan.
And I say
30 years. You say 40.
I've had kids. It's 40. I've had kids that got their grade 12 and that hated school and have not actually gone any further. I have children who don't work, who can't work. You know, my daughter, who I talk about, is raising her kids. She's the nicest human being I've ever met in my life. Mm-hmm. And she is happy and she loves her children and she can't work, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Her partner works, and she does work. She, on the side, she makes the most yummy desserts and she sells them for big bucks.
Don't even put her near me. I'll go bankrupt. That's what I'm talking about. Okay. So this really is excellent. And if we were to, because you've given some really good insight into what really matters and not worrying about other people. And I guess that's why support is so important, because if you could think that way, but when you're getting told it's not that way and you don't really have a circle of support as a caregiver, did you have some support growing up? I know you have a best buddy who is a support, but did you advertently or inadvertently surround yourself with people, tethered yourself to good people?
I didn't really have long-term relationships because of my relational issues. And I believe that probably compounding my issues is an attachment disorder because of how much my mom left me when I was little. But I didn't have great long-term relationships, but I did have a good relationship with my mom. And despite her own disability, she's a very intuitive woman. Like, whenever I'm in trouble, she knows, and she'll say, I think you're in trouble. You need to talk to me about this. She used to call me and say, I think you're in trouble. Do you need to move back home? And she would be bang on. And I'd be like, yes. She'd be like, okay, I'll send your dad to come and get you. So she was one of those supports. And I think I moved back home to live with my parents at least 6 times in my young adulthood. Before I moved to Sioux Lookout to be a child welfare worker, I actually lived at home. So that was a good support. You know, that ability for my parents to forget all of my transgressions, come get me and let me come back home. And I do the same with my own children because of that. And every time they come back home, their life gets better and better and better, even though they make mistakes. And so now I do have a best friend and I have a husband, and I met them both the same year. And so I've been in relationship with them, I think, for 25 years. And of course, I have an older sister who rescued me many times in my life, and I still have a very close relationship with her.
So good. So good. Now I want to transition to this, because this is also excellent. I want to make sure we hit this. You made this video, Picture This, Life as a Parent with FASD. Do you mind explaining a little bit about the project? What I would like to do, use your full words, Jeffrey. What I would then like to do is play a couple of clips from this video, and then we will leave this video on our blog at fasdsuccess.com/podcast. And you will have you'll see the newest episodes, and you could access it. So it's awesome. And if you could let us know where this came from, how it came about, what it is about, and then I'll cut to some stuff.
Sure. So back in 2007, I believe, there was a woman by the name of Krista Lauer. She was seeking a master's degree, and I think it was in health, through the University of Scotland. And she had heard about the family support program in Sioux Lookout. And so she reached out to Judy Kay. What she wanted to do was do a photo voice project with K caregivers of children with FASD. And her main focus was to figure out what it was like being a caregiver of Aboriginal children with FASD. So Judy Kay, the Family Support Program Coordinator, reached out to mothers who she felt were in a position to participate in the project, and she brought us all together. And so we all came together, we worked with Krista, she got us to go out and take pictures of what it was like being a caregiver of a child with FASD. And then we would bring our pictures back and we would do some sessions with each other, sharing and caring. It was a very woman-centered, there were no men in the project. It was very woman-centered. It was very loving, set up in a really loving way. And then we would go off and create narratives for our favorite pictures. And then as a group, we brought all of the pictures, all of the narratives together, and we agreed as a group which ones we should use. And then she took it all away and she came back with this beautiful display that she had made with huge glossy pictures and display boards. And she gave it to us and she said, okay, this is a participatory action group project. I have my research goals completed. This project now belongs to you. Take it and change the world.
Jeez.
And so that's what we did.
And so I want to play a clip. And so the clip is, it's moms, it's Aboriginal moms explaining their what it's like caring for an individual on the spectrum. Oh, yeah.
Oh, one more thing. One of the things that she wanted to do was talk about what it was like to parent children with FASD from an Aboriginal perspective. But we didn't allow her to do that. We felt like it would paint a picture that FASD was an Aboriginal disability.
Got it.
And so we said, no, we can't do that. So one of the things she said at the end of her project, she thanked us for allowing, for forcing her to change her thinking. And actually, that's what that type of research is supposed to do. So it ended up going really well.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. Thanks for that. And so there's three clips that I want to play. I can even stop after each one. But it's not the full video. This is just a sampler, because we want you to go check it out.
Brick wall. Parenting children with FASD sometimes feels like banging your head against a brick wall. I've learned how to walk around instead of trying to break the wall or my child's spirit. Debs.
In the driver's seat. This is what my life felt like parenting children with FASD. Going 100 kilometers an hour all the time, running out of gas, veering off course, with no police around, no gas station, and no rest area. Just a long, lonely road ahead. So please don't assume we have everything under control. Bonnie.
A tree needs support to survive. My child was born with FASD. He needed support to grow and develop into a strong young man. This is what this tree symbolizes to me. He and I, growing together, interlinked. My son needs support close to him to help guide him and provide monitoring throughout his life. He needs an external brain to always be in the background and alongside him. With this, he will succeed. I do this for him every day. Rhonda.
Constant change. The water brings in different things every day, from garbage to treasure. You have to sort through it and find out what is treasure to you and what is garbage. Not only is the water bringing things in, but it is always coming in at a different rate. From softly lapping against the sand to crashing into it and changing the sand's form. Every day is a constant challenge to figure out my child's needs in each particular moment. I never know how he's going to react. I never know what I'll be dealing with, a lion or a lamb.
Awesome. Right? What a great project. And you guys can check out more. That was just a few clips. If you want to even Google it yourself, YouTube it. Picture this, life as a parent of children with FASD. There's a few things. They're right. I like the soft music. And then it's like I've beaten my head against the wall every day. Like it's because that's what it is. But they say it so softly, right? True. And so what was her lesson she learned to go around the wall? Now, was this after you provided training, or were these strategies or conclusions that they came to on their own?
I had attended a lot of FASD training before that. Well, not a lot, some FASD training before that. And I had been out to speak to groups one time before we did this project. But it was this project that actually caused all of the parents to just really, you know, pick up the project and go out there and do some things. So right after this project was finished, the National Film Board actually found it in Kenora at our annual general meeting. We had placed it in the back of a room back there. And a guy from the National Film Board happened to be staying in Kenora. He left a note for me at the front desk and he said, please call me about this project. And that's how it became a video.
Oh, that's excellent. Yeah, because it is great. I like how the one mom says, don't assume that we have everything in control, like that we were in control of everything. So then if we're not assuming, then what do we do for a mom like that? If I see a mom and I say, okay, I'm not assuming, how do I help them?
I think you can help. Any parent of a child with FASD is just like a child with FASD. They're unique and they have their own needs. You know, I've been saying for 15 years, if somebody, I don't need respite, I don't need counseling, I don't need any of those stuff because I'm a lefty, you know, I figure this stuff out on my own. But I would like it if somebody would come along and clean my car twice a year. Just clean it, do the detailing, do all that stuff so that I don't have to freak out when people are spilling their food or dropping their gum or, you know what I mean? That would reduce my stress. So what I mean to say when I tell you that is that everybody is unique. And so we shouldn't be just looking to what our policies say are things that we can use to support people. I do have an interesting story about being creative with supports if you want to hear it.
We got no timeline, man. We can go as long as we want. Let her go.
Okay, so there was a family that was placed in a community, and they had a little boy who had FASD, and they were in the middle of major renovations in their home. And so they did all the renovations at night when their child was, during the day when their child was in school, because he had major sensory issues. And he kept getting kicked out of school, and so they couldn't get to the renovations. So I had known about FASD before that, and I had known that we need to be really, really creative. So we hired a one-to-one worker under the guise that he was providing one-to-one support for the child, but he was actually very good at carpentry, and he finished the renovations while the foster mom spent time with the child, and we helped with that connection. But I had to do it on the down low. Not too many people knew that's what was going on because it wouldn't have fit the profile of what support we could use.
That's the name of the game sometimes, is coming up with a plan or how to have people buy in, you know, both on the spectrum and caregivers too, because there's a wall. Individuals put up a wall because the message that they've been hearing is independence, 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 and we are grooming you to do it on your own. And, you know, my parents said this to me, and I'm sure your parents said this to you. Oh, maybe your mom sounds pretty chill. But, you know, the messaging in general is when you get older, you're going to have to pay your own bills. You're going to have to take care of your home. You're going to have to raise your kids. I won't always be around to do this. And then I find that if that message is constant, individuals just on the spectrum are just like us. They just want to be normal. And so if now expecting to accept help in this way isn't normal and it doesn't mean you're independent, they're against it. Same thing with caregivers. Nobody can do it like me. I'm the only one who could do it. I'm last on the totem pole. You know, I need to take care of everybody else first. And that just doesn't work. And so you have to almost get them to buy in with these strategies for them to accept it.
Well, you got to figure out what they need as individuals. So for me, you know, I want my car clean. I wouldn't mind a housekeeper once a month just to do that deep stuff so that I'm not running around on Saturday afternoons being all pissed off at my kids because they wrecked the house.
Yeah.
And training. Training for me, if I go for FASD training, it reboots me. It helps me to remember my children have FASD. It gives me all those things that I need. And when I go to training, I always pay for my own training because sometimes I can go to every one of the sessions and sometimes I need to go take a nap in between. And so I pay for my own so I have that flexibility and people aren't saying, well, you know, Debbie wasn't at that session at 2:00. She's probably out shopping. you know, I love to go to training, but I love to learn at my own pace when I'm at training. So that's what I need.
Right. So sometimes a session fills you up and you need to go have a nap.
Yep.
Yeah. So that there's room for more, right?
Just pay for my own. Yeah. Because, you know, with my sensory issues, sitting for 3 days in training, by that time, my legs are killing me. My toes are feeling funny. Yep. I'm being hijacked by my senses at the end even a full day.
I like how you said that. And you're a mega professional academia. Imagine our kids, you know, who maybe even have less tools, right? Maybe, you know, more of their brain domains have been impacted. And yet we expected them to do all these things.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's why if you go to the FASD conferences where the kids with FASD are invited, you'll usually see that they're getting up and they're going. They have their computers in front of them, their iPads. They're doing whatever it is they need to do, and their parents are letting them do that. And I use that as an example lots of times when I'm talking to people about who expect kids to sit all day in the classroom.
Everyone's just trying to regulate.
Yeah.
And they have a different way of doing it, I believe, because nobody wants to be an a-hole. That's one of the things when I train, I say, you know, when you were a kid, or have you ever asked a kid what you wanted to be when you grew up? Did you ever hear a kid stand up and say, you know what, when I grow up, I want to be an asshole. I want to make my parents' life a living hell. I want to make it tough to get up to school. And then when I get to school, you know, I want to be aggressive. I want to get removed from the school. And, you know, I want to be suspended. And, you know, I don't want to finish school. And I might try high school, but that's as far as I'm going to get. And you know what? I also want mental health issues and addictions. And I don't want to finish school. I don't want to get a job. I want to be on the street or in jail. Did you ever hear a kid say that?
Was there never.
So why is it happening? That's my when I drop the mic moment in my trainings, because then why is it happening?
Well, and I think, you know, you mentioned that a lot of people feel this way about my current understanding about school. But school for some kids who can't do school is a pathway to prison. And I know that because I've seen it. I've seen it as a child welfare worker. I've watched as we forced our kids to do things that made them feel terrible all day, every day. And then when they weren't forced anymore, when they realized they had a voice, they went out and they started getting engaged in things that weren't healthy for them. Or when they're at school, they get into high school and then they start skipping out because there's no eyes on them.
Yeah, because nobody's, it isn't, the attendance isn't really as intense. At least scrutinized. Yeah, no, I get it 100%. It's not, school isn't for everybody. It's for some people. But you know, everybody has something that they're like, and they're good at. And sometimes it just needs a little bit more polish. And because of executive functioning issues, they just need a little bit more support around it. You know, I say anybody could do anything with support. Like just look at world politics. You know, you can do anything. If there's enough people around you to make it happen. Now you're making something happen. You're making a PhD happen.
Yes.
Tell me about that journey. What's it about? What are you doing? What do you hope to get with a doctorate, right? Is that?
So I am pursuing a doctorate in educational sustainability at Nipissing University, and I'm in my almost third year. I'm finished all of my coursework, and I wanted to get a PhD because I want to be a full-time teacher. So I don't work in child welfare anymore. I do some sessional lecturing for Confederation College, and I work in the FASD certificate program at Sioux College. But I want to be a full-time professor. I want to spend my time teaching people about FASD, about social services, that sort of thing. So again, I'm finished all my coursework, and I'm just working on my comprehensive exams. And my dissertation, what I'm going to do is I am going to spend time with my mom. I'm going to call it Hitchhiking with Mom, because when I was a little girl, we did a lot of hitchhiking. And I want to go back and I want to revisit all of those stories of her life. She had a very, very hard life as a woman with a disability, and she had significant cognitive disabilities. She only went to school up until grade 6. And then her mom would let her sneak home and sit in the kitchen and drink tea with her till my grandfather got home from work. But I want to tell her stories with a new perspective. I was angry with my mom for not being a good mom, for leaving me, for taking me hitchhiking across the country. You know, I experienced some significant abuses during those times. She put me at a lot of risk. And, You know, I had a really hard time forgiving her until I learned about FASD, until I realized that what was happening with her and her poor judgment and all of that had to do with her own disabilities of FASD. So I want to revisit those stories with her. My mom is a storied person. I think in a storied way because she told me all these stories all my life. But I want to see them with new eyes, with a fresh perspective, an FASD perspective, and an understanding of all of her marginalized identities as a woman with a disability. She was poor, she was a single mom. And in those days, they didn't have any financial supports for women who weren't married. So her full-time job became to find a husband with these two kids, and she ended up in an abusive relationship. So I want to revisit those stories with a fresh perspective.
That's awesome. You're the female version of the most interesting person in the world. That's who you remind me of. Like, you know, there's a lot to uncover, and I appreciate that about you, you know, and I'm glad you're in my circle. Because I love it when you get to interact with my audience and, you know, the folks that that take my coaching experience. So thank you for that. So this is what's happening next? Like, okay, let me end it here. Like, what are you doing when COVID is done? Like, when all these restrictions go away? What are you missing the most and want to just do?
Well, I'm going to travel. My hope was, so my sister recently moved to BC, and that's actually where my mom used to hitchhike to all the time with me. So we would hitchhike from Sault Ste. Marie all the way to BC, and I was 3 years old. And so I hope when COVID's done, I think I'm going to pack up the car with my mom, and her and I are going to go back to BC. And we're going to stop at some of those places that she stopped when she was on the Greyhound bus sometimes with me or hitchhiking, and we're just going to talk. That's my dream. My bucket list will be completed if I get an opportunity to do that with her.
And then you'll also then go back to Nipissing when you're doing your work?
No, I'm finished all my coursework at Nipissing. So everything I do now is on my own.
Well, that's a bummer because I just so happen to live where Nipissing is. And we missed each other by a quick COVID. But honestly, Debbie, thank you so much for doing it. Thank you for being open, dude. Like, you didn't have to do any of this. And it's just my audience. I know they appreciate it. So thanks for coming on.
You're welcome. And thank you, Jeff.
Oh, my goodness, Debbie, you were straight fire. Thank you so much, man. You didn't have to share as much as you did, but I really appreciate that you did. What an amazing story. We literally could do an after show that could be another hour long. I don't want to make it an hour long because I respect your time, but I do have something to say. I did take notes. I took a lot of notes, and you probably took a lot of notes as well. Okay, here we go. So here's a few things I wanted to unpack. Because if she identifies as being on the spectrum or, you know, prenatally exposed, that just weaves so many different narratives. And she didn't really realize until she took a class in university. Could you imagine? I have this conversation a lot, but I try to put myself in somebody's shoes who goes for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years without really knowing why they act the way they do, why they think the way they do, why they have the outcomes the way they do. They think it's all because of them. But it's not, because it's their brain that was prenatally exposed to alcohol, not their fault. The injury was during actual development, and she always thought that she had issues because of her mother and the instability that she had in terms of placement stability and the hitchhiking across. This could be, man, a movie of the week, no doubt, no doubt. And so then she showed her dad. That's huge. She showed her stepdad, and we hear this often. That I hear this often. Say when I'm doing a training or somebody's listening to the podcast, and I get comments or questions at jeff@fasdforever.com. You can send them there. People saying like, this is the first time I heard about FASD, and it was either me or it was my kid or it was somebody that I know and I love. And, you know, bringing that to the parents and them having ding, 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 because parents are always searching for answers all day, every day, right? If something's not going the way we think it should be going with our kid, we get worried and we just start to think and we perseverate, which means that we get stuck and that's all we're thinking about. And it makes us exhausted, but because we want to fix, we want to fix, we want to know what's going on. And to have her dad say, well, that's you, man. That is you. And I like how she was so candid about the truth of when she was growing up and it was bar time. So she would sit with her friends who were pregnant and they were drinking because that was like status quo. So you're right. We can't get upset. We can't, you know, bash maternal mothers, which is a huge no-no in my realm because they didn't know. They didn't have the right information. Same thing with my mom. You know, I talk about my sister, talk about in trainings. You know, she was married to a minor and they did, like he worked really hard and on the weekend they did two things. They drank and they made babies. Like that's what happened. And so it's good to hear that she's got that positive relationship with no resentment towards her mom. And then they become parents and they become foster parents. And then they specifically requested that they don't want somebody with they didn't want somebody with a disability. And so they got someone with a disability, and that might have been you, either been a foster parent or an adoptive parent. You weren't expecting, nor did you at the time want an individual with some sort of intellectual disabilities, but they just intuitively did things and it worked. And it wasn't that nice what she talked about her daughter who was giving her the most troubles. And now she's saying, the most challenging child I have has become the most amazing adult. She's a good mom. She cuddles with her kids. She connects with her kids and she's so nice to me. She's so sweet to me. That's what we want. I mean, I'm not going to speak for you. But if we think about those hopes and dreams that we had before we acquired our kids, however we did it, maternally or adoptive, foster, however, that's the end goal we had. And you could still get there. It just looks different. So the fact that after everything that she went through with her daughter and how hard it was, she's turned out to be the most amazing, amazing adult. And that makes me feel so good. And that's why I said that. And she goes, oh, anyway. I said, no, that's not an anyway. That's an everything. Relationship is everything. And then when they went to get her daughter diagnosed, her daughter didn't even get a diagnosis until she was 16, because when they went to take her daughter to get a diagnosis, they said, because I believe it's what she said, I forget now, but that she said because she was too tall. Whatever the reason, I hear these reasons all the time. I hear the reason about, oh, they don't have the facial features, so they can't get a diagnosis. Well, guess what, Bob? 90% of individuals who are prenatally exposed to alcohol have no facial features. That's less than 10% of the population. So if you run into doctors like that, that's a red flag, man. They have no idea what they're talking about. And furthermore, I'll just jump ahead a little bit. When Debbie went to get her assessment, they said, you can't have it because you're too smart. And that just goes to show you that it's not like an angry, what are you talking about? What are you doing? That needs to be an empathetic, oh man, they have no idea because they were never trained. Because if they were trained, they would know that there's 10 brain domains, especially in the Canadian diagnostic guidelines, and your intellect is just one part of your brain. It doesn't make the whole engine go. It drives me, but... That totally comes down to a lack of education. So just back to what she was talking about her daughter when she finally did get the diagnosis. And she said, hey, how do you feel? And she said, the relief was incredible. I feel so good because I always felt like I wasn't trying hard enough. I was less than. You hear that over and over, at least I do, when interviewing, when talking to individuals on the spectrum. I always thought it was me. I thought it was because I was stupid. So if you're a parent and you're ever wondering, is it worth getting a diagnosis? Is it absolutely, emphatically, yes, it is. And I like how she talked about advocating. What did she say? She said, people were less likely to listen to me if I was lecturing them. I was once told, talk with people about the disability, not at people. And to top it off, Debbie was so forthcoming about her own symptoms and how her sensory system was so sensitive it hijacked her thinking to the point it was hard for her to have relationships. I can say that again. It was her sensory system was so sensitive it hijacked her thinking to the point it was hard for her to have relationships. Think about in your own life with your own loved ones or even yourself that your symptoms hijack your thinking. It takes over for your thinking because you can't regulate those. And then she said, I like how she turned the table here. How do you love someone who smells bad, touches you wrong, talks too much, etc., etc.? Think about it. She's like, we often think, how can we love an individual on the spectrum when they do the same thing over and over and over again? There's meltdowns and there's aggressions and a myriad of symptoms that we deal with. She's flipping the script and say, hey, how do I love someone who smells bad, touches you wrong, talks too much? She's flipping the script. She's like, no. Like, how can I get along with you when you are like this? When you have sensory issues, it's very hard to have satisfying relationships. I like how she put satisfying in front of a relationship. Because, you know, we could often have shallow relationships, but I believe individuals on the spectrum are going for that too. We all want that, like satisfying relationships. We are social creatures, man. She just said it so well. And then she says, I felt like such a heel. Well, that's a great word. I that's a professional wrestling word for like a bad person, like a bad guy, you know, in professional wrestling. I don't know if you ever saw it, but you usually know what I'm talking about. You have the good guy and the bad guy, and the bad guy was called a heel. So it was neat to see her say that word, right? She felt like a bad wife, a bad friend, bad community member, and she felt like a bad person. Why am I like this? It's when the symptoms get in the way of success. But then when she internalized and say, yes, I believe I am on the spectrum, I can start to work with this and I can help others around me work with me as well. That was so awesome. It was so good. And I'm almost done. And when I talked to her, I asked her about her 3 points. What would she tell a caregiver? And I don't know if you noticed, we only got to one, but it was so good that we took a deep dive. And we just talked about forgetting about societal expectations. She says, love where they're at. Love who they are. He is going to learn what he needs to do, and I'm going to help support that. It's all about relationship and connections. And that, you know, even one of her sons does not go to school because he's less aggressive. He's a better person. And now I'm not talking to you to tell you to take your kid out of school, but just doing what is often the opposite of what society thinks. To make sure that we put our kids, our loved ones on the spectrum in such a great environment where they could thrive and show their strengths. And it's possible. It is absolutely possible. Debbie, thank you so much. Hey, listen, if you're still listening to this an hour and a bit in, I just want to thank you. This is the end of the show crew, right? This is the end of the show crew who listened all the way. And I really appreciate that you do. And I appreciate the emails that you give me. Hey, I also appreciate the fact that so many of you came to the free training that I gave. That was a lot of fun to actually see people, see your sweet face, because usually I'm just staring into a microphone and chatting. But it was nice. It was nice, and hopefully we could do those again in the future, although, the podcast, everything else we're doing inside of FASD Success. We are super busy. But, you know, in October, we're going to be putting on our Caregiver Kickstart again. And so I have no doubt I will freaking let you know about that. But hey, that's what I was talking about. Spring. Spring has sprung. You've made it. And I know you might turn on the news and do a little bit of doom scrolling at night, but let's just look at the facts. Like, you are here with everything that you've been dealing with, right? Mentally and emotionally and spiritually and with being a partner or being a parent and navigating those waters. Well, it is some of the toughest times in terms of human history when it comes to psyche. You're still making it. You are still moving forward one foot in front of the other. And if you are stuck in some mud, we need to take a real deep look into how do we get you unstuck. And one of the first ways is to get unstuck is to get a helping hand, you know, to have someone help pull you out of the mud. And we can do that. We do that by giving you access to our free Facebook group, facebook.com/group/FASD forever. There's over 4,000 other caregivers, frontline workers, awesome people in there to make sure you don't have to do this alone. You don't have to do this alone. Look how strong you are. Could you imagine with a few thousand people behind you? So, you know, you don't have to do this alone. So come do it with us. Guess what? One of the people she talked about in her interview, she said Rainer DeSmit. He's an individual on the, an adult on the spectrum, and he gave some great insight. Well, we are going to have him next week, and we have a great, great conversation. So keep kicking ass. Keep grinding. Keep doing what you're supposed to be doing. Putting on a smile, being that light, that beacon for people, and making sure that you're recharging your batteries so you can be that person, because I know you are. You're an absolute badass. Keep up the effing good work. I will see you back here. Same bad time, same bad channel. I love you. Until then, we'll talk then. All right. Bye.